If you stumbled on this by accident, you've stumbled on the Far Middle Podcast. My name's Nick DeOlias. And if you're a constant listener, welcome back. Either way, we're happy to have you. Episode 34 of the Far Middle Podcast and picking the dedication and the athlete to affix to episode 34 came down to two individuals, both of them running backs with great and epic careers. The one that I didn't go with, that I was torn with, though, was Earl Campbell, the great Earl Campbell from Texas. And then, of course, with the Oilers in the NFL. Boy, was he awesome. I just think of Earl Campbell and a couple things come to mind. Those tearaway jerseys that were popular in college as well as the pros back in the day. Another thing about Earl Campbell, his running style, I mean, it was just so tough. But one of the sort of historic collisions in NFL history occurred down in the Astrodome, I believe, between him and Donnie Shell. And I think that was Earl Campbell's rookie season. But Steelers fans, Oilers fans, Earl Campbell fans, Donnie Shell fans, they're all aware of what I'm talking about, where Earl Campbell was running and basically got caught a little off balance from a prior would-be tackler. Might have been, I don't know if it was Jack Ham, I can't remember who was almost there to tackle, but just caught off balance, spinning around. And when he was spinning around, Donnie Shell just caught him. And there was just a hit that Donnie Shell laid on Earl Campbell with his ribs and laid Earl Campbell out. But it just showed, even though you're a Steeler fan at the time, like I was, and Earl Campbell sort of got the worst of that one, you just had great respect for the way that guy approached the game of football and how he put, you know, every ounce of effort that he had into running the ball. And then a third thing that I think of with Earl Campbell, besides the tearaways and the Donnie Shell collision during his rookie season, was that really just unbelievable Monday Night Football game between the Oilers and Miami Dolphins, 1978. I remember being allowed to stay up late as a 10-year-old kid watching that back and forth game, and Earl Campbell just had one heck of a game. That's probably the greatest Monday Night Football game of all time. And if you get a chance to sort of watch that again from the archives, I'd encourage you to do so. But I didn't go with Earl Campbell, as much as I love him. Instead, I had to go with a running back that I love even more. I think one of the greatest running backs of all time, definitely top three running back of all time. And his name is Walter Payton, or maybe some people know him better as Sweetness. All-American kid, you know, Walter Payton growing up in Mississippi, was in the choir. He was a Boy Scout. He played Little League. Basically grew up in a southern small town, just something you would think of when you think of Americana. Picked in the first round by the Bears in 75. I think he was the fourth overall pick in the NFL draft. And really, he was hoped to be the answer, the filling of the void, the savior for the Bears from the void that was left when Gale Sayers retired in 72. So there's a couple years of a gap there, and the Bears were looking for that next answer to take them to the next level, open up their new chapter. And they were hoping that Walter Payton was going to be it. And boy, did he deliver in a big way. Now, we all know, you know, his story as to what happened to him after his playing career, tragic story with liver disease and the complications from it, ultimately taking him at a much too early age. Some other things you might have not known about Walter Payton. He was a drummer. He loved to drum in a rock and jazz band. And because he loved playing in a band so much, it sort of stopped him, at least, from pursuing football in high school. That he said in prior interviews that it was his love of playing in a band, and he thought that the coach in football wouldn't allow him to do both. And when he found out that the coach was okay with him doing both, he was more open to playing football. But also, he didn't want to compete with his brother. Some of you might remember his brother, Eddie Payton. Well, he also was a bit older than Walter, but played football on the high school team. And for whatever reason, Walter felt that if he went out for the football team, it would take playing time away from him. Maybe they played the same position, I guess, from his brother, Eddie. So that was sort of a deterrent too. But thankful for football fans, Walter did ultimately make it to his high school football team and took off from there through college, Jackson State. And then, of course, with the Bears and the pros. His motto was really cool. I think he's got one of the best personal mottos that you'll hear from an athlete: never die easy. If you look at the way he ran, that was the way he approached the game of football and the running back position. He never died easy. He held the most consecutive starts for a running back in NFL history when he retired at 170, which is an amazing statistic when you look at endurance, especially considering the way that he ran, very much like Earl Campbell. He didn't run out of bounds that often. He would fight for every extra yard that he could. And a little other sort of detail with Walter Payton that I always thought was neat. I heard him once a long time ago in an interview. I think it was a written story where he would talk about after he was, and if you watch this on film, you can see this. After he'd be tackled, he would always, almost as a habit, he would grab the football and just move it up about 6 inches from, you know, where he was tackled. And he'd get up and go back to the huddle. And the ref inevitably would get the ball and place it back closer to where he was actually tackled at, where the proper spot of the ball would be. But he thought through the years, after this thousands and thousands of carries and doing that every single time, that he probably amassed 100 extra yards in his statistics because of the ref, maybe instead of, if he moved it up 6 inches, Walter Payton did, maybe the ref only moved it back 3 inches or 4 inches over time, that accumulated into a pretty impressive extra sort of padding of his cumulative yardage, which I thought was a pretty cool story. Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, given out every year by the NFL. I think that says something when they're naming a humanitarian award after you. That must mean that you've had an impact on people throughout your career. And the other thing that I think of with Walter Payton, and again, this goes back to just era, right? We dedicated the prior episode, two episodes ago, to Jim Brown, who I never saw play because of just my age versus when he played. I had a chance to watch Walter Payton on TV during a very impressionable time when I was a kid, when it came to sports. And this sort of ties into that. I don't know if any of you, similar age of me, but have any memories of those Sports Illustrated posters, those giant posters of different football players that you could buy and put on your bedroom wall. But I think of Walter Payton, I think of his Sports Illustrated poster from the 1980s. He had one of the better ones. Steelers ones were awesome. I mean, my bedroom at the time in my brother's bedroom was just plastered. You couldn't see the paint on the walls because of, you know, Joe Green and Jack Lambert. I remember Jack Ham's Sports Illustrated poster. Terry Bradshaw had an awesome one. So did Walter Payton. Those Sports Illustrated posters back in those early 80s era, they had some great action shots of those players. And I think of Walter Payton, I think of his in particular. So episode 34, well-deserved dedication to one of the greatest running backs in the history of the National Football League and probably its best person, its best representative, Walter Sweetness Payton. So let's start connecting dots, and let's start and jump from Sweetness and how he ran hard with his motto, never die easy, right, running hard, to something else that is not maybe so much running hard, but running hot lately, and that is the stock market. Stock markets are sitting at record highs. We've talked about this a couple of times before on the Far Middle. Ended year-end 21 at all-time highs with the S&P. So the S&P certainly at all-time highs. The Dow's not far behind. And anything these days causes a rally. So if you, and some of that stuff can actually be bad news or should be viewed as bad news. So inflation, right? If inflation is raging, hey, that's an excuse for a demand-driven rally today in the markets. Fed talking about tapering, well, that's going to be a rally because we're getting back to quote-unquote normal. If it's Christmas, hey, let's expect a Santa Claus rally. We saw that at the year-end 21 as well. If Fed's talking about 2022 rate hikes, then let's rally based off of that. And if you've got spending bills in Congress or from the administration, it's going to cause massive deficit spending, rally. It makes me think of the Brady Bunch. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Brady Bunch or not, but remember Jan, the one sister, and her lament in a famous episode of the Brady Bunch where she was saying, Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Well, for me, when I'm looking at the stock market these days, it's now turned increasingly into my lament of not Marsha, 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 but rally, rally, rally. But I would urge you to beware and maybe give me a chance here to try to sober you up a bit from all this rally excess. And I want to talk about a key spread that really, I think, matters. It's mattered historically for hundreds of years, and I don't know why it wouldn't apply or matter today. And that spread is the difference between inflation that you're seeing and Treasury bond yields. So the difference between inflation and the 10-year Treasury bill, it hasn't been this wide since the 1970s. And by the way, I don't think I need to remind you, the 1970s, they weren't exactly a time of economic or stock market nirvana, in case you weren't around then or you don't recall. It was a mess in the 1970s. You look at real bond yields, and the difference between the, so real bond yields from my perspective, when I think of describing that, I think of it as the difference between the 10-year treasury bill rate and inflation. So normally, and under normal times, bond yields exceed inflation and the real yield is positive. That's what you're getting paid for. That's sort of the premium you're getting paid for versus inflation to invest in the instrument. But when you've got inflation higher than the 10-year treasury yield, that's what we got today, that spells negative real yields for bonds. That's sort of a strange situation, an uncommon situation. It's become quite common lately, not just in the United States, but across all kinds of different economies across the globe. And when you've got negative real yields for bonds, that spells SOS in financial and economic distress, at least historically it did, for hundreds of years. So in history, when this real yield went as negative as it is now, people, markets, governments, they all freaked out, and rightfully so. So negative real yields for treasury bills, that always meant plunging stock markets. Those two things correlated. When you had negative real yields in the treasury bill market, that was not going to be good news for what the stock market was doing. Just to give you a case in point, 1974, right smack in the middle of the 70s and all the chaos that was tied to that decade, real yields hit minus 4.9%. And what did the S&P 500 do that year in 1974? It fell almost 40%. But today, okay, if we fast forward to what we saw in 2021, record highs in the markets, rally, 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 Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Today, real yields, they're minus 4.7%. So they're not that far off from that 1974 real yield negative level. And the S&P, it's not down almost 40%. It's up 30+% in 2021, looking back on the prior year. So what gives? You know, what is different? Why is this happening? And why is history no longer seems to apply to what's going on in the markets in 2021 or going into 2022. Well, you know, simply put, I think in a sort of entity to pin it on, it would be the Fed. The Fed is rigging the bond market by its massive interventions. We've talked about this in the past, but I think it's really starting to become such a massive issue that's sitting there in plain sight. It's sort of strange that more aren't clamoring on this topic. And there's not bond vigilantes that are out there that you used to have in prior times that are dumb enough or brave enough to challenge a Fed when you've got a Fed of this size and this presence in the active market. It is the market. So how can you take on the Fed in that type of an environment? The Fed rigging the bond market, if you recall, that was started and that was justified in what was an emergency situation, right, as it was sort of presented, coming off of the financial crisis back in 08, 09. And then the Fed, it never stopped with the emergency measures since 2010, I think, when it all started from the Fed perspective, coming off that 08, 09 financial crisis. So it's been a decade plus of unique, one-time emergency measures for an existential threat that has long passed. So the one-time unicorn situation to fight this special existential crisis, it's now the usual, the normal for over a decade, and we're all tied and we're all addicted to it. Folks, there is no private sector free market in bonds. And as a result, all the asset classes that price off of bond yields, it could be stocks particularly, right, as well as other asset classes, there's no private sector free market for them anymore as well. The Fed has destroyed it. Now we take whatever pricing the faceless economist bureaucrat specifies after running his or her model, whatever that model is and whatever it's based on. Market price discovery, you know, for bonds and for equities, that's gone. That's scary. That makes me very anxious, makes me want to exit the market. And I definitely would want this to stop with respect to the massive Fed intervention, but I'm not sure we're going to get that wish anytime soon. Let's jump to our next dot to connect. And let's shift from government rigging bond markets and equity markets to government rigging something else, pandemic science. So maybe it's time for a drum roll, because that means we're going to be having our Fauci focus moment, one of those intermittent features on the Far Middle podcast. So again, going back to Dr. Fauci, he's sort of a scientist when you look at what his responsibilities are and his training and his background, and he's sort of a politician when you see him up there on the podium and his attention and liking of the limelight. Now, which is he more of? Because that's important, right, when it comes to millions of American lives and how we deal with pandemic. So Fauci Focus tries to answer that question on whether he's leaning towards the politician side or whether he's leaning towards the objective scientific side. Is he a scientist or is he a political scientist? Now, if you're a Fauci fan, this Fauci Focus moment is going to be a tough one to listen to because I've got some sort of disturbing news to discuss. Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, right, FOIA, unearthed emails between Dr. Fauci and a Dr. Collins. Now, Dr. Collins is the director of the National Institute of Health, or NIH, so another important leader with respect to government and the medical profession and pandemic that affects all of us. And I guess thanks is owed to the American Institute for Economic Research for exposing these troubling emails when they push for them to be daylighted under FOIA. So let me back up a second and talk about where a lot of these emails sort of originate from, what the issue is. And that really starts with the Great Barrington Declaration. Now, the Great Barrington Declaration was a statement by leading medical scientists. They're from Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford, were sort of the big three originators of the declaration, that basically argued against widespread blanket shutdowns to manage COVID. Instead, what the leaders of the Great Barrington Declaration were arguing for was heightened protections for the elderly and these at-risk pre-existing condition demographics, right? So more of a surgical, let's beef up our defenses for the most vulnerable, but beyond the most vulnerable, let's avoid these widespread blanket shutdowns when we're dealing with COVID. Thousands of scientists signed this declaration. And in hindsight, sitting here in early 2022, it looks to be 100% correct with respect to its recommendations and its recommended approach. And I bet you've never heard of the Great Barrington Declaration. How strange is that? And I wonder why you've never heard of it. Well, maybe we've got some possible explanations because Dr. Collins at the NIH and Dr. Fauci, they didn't like the Great Barrington Declaration. They didn't agree with it. Sort of went against what they wanted, which of course were the more widespread lockdowns and quarantines and travel bans and all that other stuff. And so did the media. The media wanted the same things that Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins and the government wanted. So here's where those emails that I talked about with their exposure under FOIA, where they come into play. And a couple of these emails I think are very telling. First, Dr. Collins, he emails Dr. Fauci and says that this proposal, and he's referencing the Great Barrington Declaration, this proposal seems to be getting a lot of attention. And he also said, quote, there needs to be a quick and devastating published takedown of its premises, end quote. Now, that email to me was quite shocking. A week later, Dr. Collins tells the Washington Post, quote, this is a fringe component of epidemiology, and quote, this is not mainstream science, quote, it's dangerous. So you can see there was a very conscious campaign by Dr. Collins to basically poison the well when it came to what the Great Barrington Declaration was advocating for. Meanwhile, while that was going on with Dr. Collins, Dr. Fauci was doing his part. He, of course, was working with various media outlets. The media loves Dr. Fauci. Dr. Fauci loves him right back. And where the circle that was going on would be one where Dr. Fauci would say something, the media treats him as an exclusive authority on all things pandemic and COVID, and then the cycle would repeat itself over and over again. If you think, you know, that this is sort of conjecture or maybe a bit of hyperbole, and if you think the media wasn't, you know, part of what was going on here, just consider social media. Just take a look at social media as an example. Facebook ended up censoring the Great Barrington Declaration. So you weren't able to read about the Great Barrington Declaration on different social media platforms. That should tell you something right there in and of itself. And again, signed by thousands of scientists. You look at where we're at today, over 800,000 American COVID deaths later, and who knows, right, what the collateral deaths were due to shutdowns and all the collateral damage that was created by people not being able to live their lives and basically take care of themselves. And we still tolerate this type of behavior from our leaders in government. These are our self-described followers of science. It makes you really wonder and scratch your head. And the more we learn, the more COVID and pandemic political science, I mean science, right? We're calling that science in mainstream media, is making climate change political science. I mean science, look respectable. I mean, literally what's going on with pandemic and how science is being commandeered, it makes climate change political science look respectable. And when government and media look to set an agenda, neither COVID or climate policies might be science or science-based or objective. And if you're a dissenter and you've got what you believe to be an objective view based or grounded in scientific theory, you should continue to speak your mind. And society should allow you to continue to speak your mind, whether you personally agree with that individual or that view or not. I think we should all be asking ourselves a question. Ask yourself this. In hindsight, now that hindsight's 2020, would it have been better to follow the Great Barrington Declaration's path or the one that Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins set us upon? I think the answer is pretty clear as we're sitting here in early 2022, still dealing with pandemic and COVID. And is anybody, do we expect anyone to account for the human devastation that entailed from promoting the chosen path and degrading and denigrating the better path, perhaps, under the Great Barrington Declaration? Don't hold your breath on that one. Let's jump to our next thought now that we're talking about not holding your breath on something. So another thing to not hold your breath on is the United States and this administration, along with Germany, standing up to the Russian bear. The Russians are massed on Ukraine's border. That's been the case now for some time, for a number of months. And meanwhile, Europe and the United States were busy issuing hollow statements to the press, like that's going to change anything. You know, looking at this situation and looking at this over the years, is there anybody out there, any leader of a country on the planet who plays a weak hand better than Putin? I don't admire the guy, but I do respect his abilities. He continues to keep much more powerful adversaries at bay, and he does that by using their weaknesses against them from time and time again. Take Germany. That's probably the best example. That's Russia's historical and more powerful enemy. Germany, what do? They ban coal. They phase out domestic natural gas. They shut down their nukes. And then Germany ends up relying big time on wind. It's about 22% of their grid capacity, and solar, which is almost 10% of their grid capacity, despite the unreliability, the intermittency, and the high costs of wind and solar. So they make these huge bets on probably the worst piece, the riskiest piece of a grid portfolio that you can think of. Now, all of that posturing, all those moves on energy sources, it creates in reality a BTU hole, an energy hole that needs to be filled. And if it's not filled, then the lights are going to go out and the homes aren't going to have heat in the winter. So the plug to fill that hole is Russian natural gas. And it's carried to Germany by the now famous Nord 2 pipeline that the Biden administration enabled while the Biden administration was shuttering domestic pipes like the Keystone pipeline. While all this is going on, and we've got a situation with winter developing like it does every year in Europe, Russia decides it's going to reduce the gas flows to the European continent, to its west, just as cold weather hits and things like the French nuclear reactors go down for maintenance, scheduled or unscheduled. So what happens, natural gas prices, they end up shooting to record highs in Europe. Is that a coincidence? You know, of course, it's not. Again, Russia and Putin are very adept at playing their cards quite well. And one of the biggest cards they've got now because of German ineptitude when it comes to energy policy is energy security. And then all of this posturing and all this reality, right, with and all the actions when it comes to Russia using their energy hand to the best of their interests, these things create a problem when it comes to energy in Germany. That's why 1 year forward prices for power in Germany, they're 300 euros per megawatt hour. That's an unbelievable level. Just to put that in perspective, those energy 1 year forward prices, they average 50 euros per megawatt hour from 2010 to 2020, the entire decade before the political science began to run energy policy instead of the science. So today, right, you got Germany in a bit of a tight spot. With Putin and Russia and Ukraine. The German chancellor, he says Nord 2, that's a private project. This was an amazing sort of view or statement from the German chancellor. Says it's a private project and the politics shouldn't interfere with its certification fate. OMG. Welcome to Russian serfdom, Germany. You did this to yourself, so you got no one else to blame but yourself. Now, meanwhile, German incompetence is second only to United States and its ineptitude when it comes to Russia and China and energy policy. Because while the German chancellor was jumping from frying pan to the fire, our feckless leaders in D.C. were making even less sense. So the United States right now, we're pressuring Germany to not certify the Nord 2 pipeline if Russia invades the Ukraine. All right, so we're trying to pressure Germany to make that commitment to try to preclude, deter Russia from jumping into Ukraine. That's ironic considering the United States could provide Germany all of its natural gas needs if the Biden administration would just simply allow pipelines to be built domestically and stop attacking the domestic natural gas industry. We could produce more, we could ship it to the coast, liquefy it via liquefied natural gas, LNG, and then ship it to Germany and across all of Europe. Problem solved when it comes to Russia using energy security as a geopolitical weapon. But even better, and this will really shock you, was the statement from our Assistant Secretary of State. Now, our Assistant Secretary of State made the following statement. I'm going to quote her. Quote, the United States sees the Nord Stream 2 pipeline as a Russian geopolitical project that undermines the energy security and the national security of a significant part of the Euro-Atlantic community. That was our Assistant Secretary of State when she was speaking to reporters. So, if Nord 2 is a geopolitical project for Russian interests, then why wouldn't Keystone, the Keystone pipeline, and the domestic natural gas industry in the United States be strategic geopolitical projects for United States and for American interests? You know, those two industries that you as an administration are looking to kill off. Whose side are these guys on down in D.C.? Let's wrap with a final dot. Let's connect the threat of the Russian bear and what's going on with Ukraine and energy security and Russia on the prowl to something that was used to wage the Cold War by the West and basically help win it in the West's favor via culture, which, of course, was rock and roll. So I want to talk a little bit about a piece that I published on the nickdeolius.com website that's got an awful lot of feedback, I guess pun intended. That's my ranking of the 10 greatest rock guitarists of all time. A lot of what I post on the website is for fun, just for interesting and notes of interest, endeavors of interest that I've got. But I got to tell you, this piece got more feedback from more people than anything else that I've published. It's strange, you know, with all this debate about energy security and government and public policy, to see this much interest and opinions being responded to with the 10 greatest rock guitarists of all time. It was a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun with the feedback. So thank you if you're one of those that that weighed in on it. And if you want to give it a read at nickdeolius.com, you can see it under the commentary section. Let me know what you think. But a couple of things from that piece. First, somebody was pointing out that, you know, you look at that list, over half of those individuals really, for different reasons, are not putting out any music, new music today. So one reason, of course, is just they've passed away. Three of the top 10 are no longer with us, Stevie Ray Vaughan. In fact, the top three, 1, 2, and 3, Stevie Ray Vaughan at number 3, Jimi Hendrix at number 2, and Eddie Van Halen at number 1, of course, no longer with us. But then you've also got three that really aren't creating new music much anymore due to deaths in their band that weren't themselves. So you've got Brian May, of course, Queen. With Freddie Mercury's death, is no longer sort of putting out new albums or new content. You got Jimmy Page with what happened to John Bonham and Led Zeppelin's breakup. And then Alex Lifeson most recently, which has been, you know, personally really devastating to me. I was a huge, gigantic Rush fan. Neil Peart, their drummer, passing away. That might be the end of Rush in terms of new music or new albums. So six, basically, of the top 10, what we've got is what we've got. Their catalog is, for the most part, set, which is sort of sad, but that's just the reality. That's the way life works. Nothing goes on forever. A lot of questions from people who are Eric Clapton fans saying you got him too low in your top 10 list. He should have been ranked much higher. He's way better than where you placed him in the list. And I sort of laid this out in the sort of the discussion on the essay itself that the Clapton, yeah, he's got, you know, a great body of work. But if you think about it, I feel that he gets a bit of an overrating. I think his best work was Layla and other assorted love songs. That was a long time ago. A lot of that stuff was co-written or not written by him. And since then, he's one of these guys. He's been very successful and he's done a lot of things, but it's not necessarily, at least from my perspective, the stuff that grabs a hold of me to the extent that the guitarists that are ranked higher than him do. There was a lot of people saying, well, these guitarists, they couldn't hold a candle to a classical guitarist or a jazz guitarist. And I completely agree. This is a rock guitarist list, not a guitarist across any sort of genre of music. Thus, if you were ranking jazz guitarists like George Benson, right, from Pittsburgh, a Pittsburgh native, I would have, you know, I probably put George Benson at the top of that list. And I agree with that, that type of view. And that's why I sort of stated that, at least with respect to jazz guitarists in the piece itself. Lindsey Buckingham. A lot of people were asking why in the world I had Lindsey Buckingham on the top 10 list of guitarists. My answer to those individuals is, you know, see him live. And then once you see him live, if you still feel that he doesn't deserve to be on the top 10 list, shoot me a note, because he's one of those rare guitarists where you don't really capture how good, how impressive of a player he is, how talented of a player he is on the CD, on the streaming, on the song, the recorded song. You got to see him live. You see him live, I guarantee you your views of him will be substantially, significantly elevated than what they were going in. So give him a chance to see him live and then tell me what you think. Eddie Van Halen, you know, what was amazing about him, and I heard some of this from some of the readers and the listeners, he's got this massive catalog that he saved in his 5150 studios in Hollywood, in the Hollywood Hills, that that have never really seen the public light of day. So, you know, the catalog of Eddie Van Halen's creations, the albums and the live performances, they are just the tip of the iceberg. Somebody, and hopefully it's Wolfgang, his son, or somebody there, needs to sort of go through those tapes and see what is deserving of hearing and being heard publicly. Because I think there will be years and years of enjoyment for Eddie Van Halen fans when it comes to letting loose with some of his catalog that was never, you know, published or never made it on albums. And then I got some questions about why, you know, where's Angus Young? How can you not have Angus Young on your top 10 list or your next 10? And my thinking with Angus Young, I like AC/DC. I'm an Angus Young fan. But I think actually he might be the number two talented ranked guitarist in that band. Malcolm Young, who passed away recently, he in many ways was the genius behind a lot of the AC/DC songs. He was a rhythm guitarist, might be the best rhythm guitarist in rock. So I was sort of torn with AC/DC because he got two great guitarists, and to attribute all of the AC/DC genius and creation and body of work to just one of the two, that's really not fair. That's not reflecting the reality of how those songs and how that group came together. So that was my thinking on Angus Young. Sort of view that as a duo, Angus and Malcolm together. Well, I hope you enjoyed episode 34 of the Far Middle Podcast. We will be back at you soon enough with episode 35. Precipice is about to hit stores and shelves. Give it a read when you get a chance. It's amazing how timely a lot of the topics, even though Precipice was written now a while ago, with just the time delays with publishing, how timely a lot of these topics are sitting here in 2022. It really is amazing that a lot of this is, if anything, even heightened interest and heightened visibility in our world today than it was a couple of short years ago. Stay safe between now and next time we talk. Until then, see you soon.